At last there came a night when everything had gone as badly as possible, and the rain, which had been falling heavily all day, had ceased at nightfall only to give place to raw cold. That morning Caspian had arranged what was his biggest battle yet, and all had hung their hopes on it. He, with most of the dwarfs, was to have fallen on the king's right wing at daybreak, and then, when they were heavily engaged, giant Wimbleweather, with the centaurs and some of the fiercest beasts, was to have broken out from another place and endeavoured to cut the king's right off from the rest of the army. But it had all failed. No one had warned Caspian, because no one in these later days of Narnia remembered, that giants are not at all clever. Poor Wimbleweather, though brave as a lion, was a true giant in that respect. He had broken out at the wrong time and from the wrong place, and both his party and Caspian's had suffered badly and done the enemy little harm. The best of the bears had been hurt, a centaur terribly wounded, and there were few in Caspian's party who had not lost blood. It was a gloomy company that huddled under the dripping trees to eat their scanty supper. The gloomiest of all was Giant Wimbleweather. He knew it was all his fault. He sat in silence, shedding big tears which collected on the end of his nose, and then fell off with a huge splash on the whole bivouac of the mice, who had just been beginning to get warm and drowsy. They all jumped up, shaking the water out of their ears and wringing their little blankets, and asked the giant in shrill but forcible voices whether he thought they weren't wet enough without this sort of thing. And then other people woke up and told the mice they had been enrolled as scouts and not as a concert party, and asked why they couldn't keep quiet. And Wimbleweather tiptoed away to find some place where he could be miserable in peace, and stepped on somebody's tail, and somebody, they said afterwards it was a fox, bit him. And so everyone was out of temper. But in the secret and magical chamber at the heart of the How, King Caspian, with Cornelius and the Badger, and Nicobrick and Trumpkin, were at council. Thick pillars of ancient workmanship supported the roof. In the centre was the stone itself, a stone table split right down the centre and covered with what had once been writing of some kind, but ages of wind and rain and snow had almost worn it away in old times, when the stone table had stood on the hilltop and the mound had not yet been built above it. They were not using the table nor sitting round it. It was too magic a thing for any common use. They sat on logs a little way from it, and between them was a rough wooden table on which stood a rude clay lamp lighting up their pale faces and throwing big shadows on the walls. "If your Majesty is ever to use the horn," said Truffle Hunter, "I think the time has now come." Caspian had, of course, told them of his treasure several days ago. "We are certainly in great need," answered Caspian. "But it is hard to be sure we are at our greatest. Supposing there came an even worse need, and we had already used it?"
"By that argument," said Nicobrick, "your Majesty will never use it until it is too late."
"I agree with that," said Dr. Cornelius.
"And what do you think, Trumpkin?" asked Caspian.
"Oh, as for me," said the Red Dwarf, who had been listening with complete indifference, "Your Majesty knows I think the horn and that bit of broken stone over there and your great King Peter and your lion Aslan are all eggs in moonshine. It's all one to me when your Majesty blows the horn. All I insist on is that the army is told nothing about it. There's no good raising hopes of magical help, which, as I think, are sure to be disappointed."
"Then in the name of Aslan, we will wind Queen Susan's horn," said Caspian.
"There is one thing, sire," said Dr. Cornelius, "that should perhaps be done first. We do not know what form the help will take. It might call Aslan himself from overseas, but I think it is more likely to call Peter the High King and his mighty consorts down from the high past. But in either case, I do not think we can be sure that the help will come to this very spot."
"You never said a truer word," put in Trumpkin.
"I think," went on the learned man, "that they, or he, will come back to one or another of the ancient places of Narnia. This, where we now sit, is the most ancient and most deeply magical of all. And here, I think, the answer is likeliest to come, but there are two others. One is Lantern Waste, upriver west of Beaversdam, where the royal children first appeared in Narnia, as the records tell. The other is down at the river mouth, where their castle of Caer Paravel once stood. And if Aslan himself comes, that would be the best place for meeting him too, for every story says that he is the son of the great emperor over sea, and over the sea he will pass. I should like very much to send messengers to both places, to Lantern Waste and the river mouth, to receive them, or him, or it. Just as a thought, muttered Trumpkin, the first result of all this foolery is not to bring us help, but to lose us two fighters.
Who would you think of sending, Dr. Cornelius? Asked Caspian.
Squirrels are best for getting through enemy country without being caught, said Truffle Hunter.
All our squirrels, and we haven't many, said Nickerbrick, are rather flighty. The only one I'd trust on the job like that would be Pattertwig.
Let it be Pattertwig, then, said King Caspian. And who for our other messenger? I know you'd go, Truffle Hunter, but you haven't the speed. Nor you, Dr. Cornelius.
I won't go, said Nickerbrick. With all these humans and beasts about, there must be a dwarf here to see that the dwarfs are fairly treated.
Thimbles and thunderstorms, cried Trumpkin in a rage. Is that how you speak to the king? Send me, sire, I'll go.
But I thought you didn't believe in the horn, Trumpkin, said Caspian.
No more I do, your majesty. But what's that got to do with it? I might as well die on a wild goose chase as die here. You are my king. I know the difference between giving advice and taking orders. You've had my advice, and now it's the time for orders.
I will never forget this, Trumpkin, said Caspian. Send for Pattertwig, one of you. And when shall I blow the horn?
I would wait for sunrise, your majesty, said Dr. Cornelius. That sometimes has an effect in operations of white magic.
A few minutes later, Pattertwig arrived and had his task explained to him. As he was, like many squirrels, full of courage and dash and energy and excitement and mischief, not to say conceit, he no sooner heard it than he was eager to be off. It was arranged that he should run for Lantern Waste while Trumpkin made the shorter journey to the river mouth. After a hasty meal, they both set off with fervent thanks and good wishes of the king, the badger, and Cornelius.
Chapter 8. How They Left the Island.
And so, said Trumpkin, for as you have realised, it was he who had been telling all this story to the four children sitting on the grass in the ruined hall of Caer Paravel. And so I put a crust or two in my pocket, left behind all my weapons but my dagger, and took to the woods in the grey of the morning. I'd been plugging away for many hours when there came a sound that I'd never heard the like of in my born days. Nay, I won't forget that. The whole air was full of it, loud as thunder but far longer, cool and sweet as music over water but strong enough to shake the woods. And I said to myself, if that's not the horn, call me a rabbit. And a moment later, I wondered why you hadn't blown it sooner.
"What time was it?"
asked Edmund. "Between 9 and 10 of the clock," said Trumpkin.
"Just when we were at the railway station," said all the children, and looked at one another with shining eyes. "Please go on," said Lucy to the dwarf.
"Well, as I was saying, I wondered, but I went on as hard as I could pelt. I kept on all night, and then, when it was half-light this morning, as if I'd no more sense than a giant, I risked a shortcut across open country to cut off a big loop of the river and was caught, not by the army, but by a pompous old fool who has charge of a little castle which is Mirazi's last stronghold towards the coast. I needn't tell you, they got no true tale out of me, but I was a dwarf and that was enough. But lobsters and lollipops! It is a good thing the Seneschal was a pompous fool. Anyone else would have run me through there and then, but nothing would do for him short of a grand execution, sending me down to the ghosts in the full ceremonial way. And then this young lady," he nodded at Susan, "does a bit of archery, and it was pretty shooting, let me tell you, and here we are. And without my armour, for of course they took that."
He knocked out and refilled his pipe.
"Great Scott!" said Peter. "So it was the horn, your own horn, Sue, that dragged us all off that seat on the platform yesterday morning.
I can hardly believe it. Yet it all fits in.
I don't know why you shouldn't believe it, said Lucy, if you believe in magic at all. Aren't there lots of stories about magic forcing people out of one place, out of one world, into another? I mean, when a magician in the Arabian Nights calls up a djinn, it has to come. We had to come, just like that.
Yes, said Peter. I suppose what makes it feel so queer is that in the stories it's always someone in our world who does the calling. One doesn't really think about where the djinn's coming from. And now we know what it feels like for the djinn, said Edmund with a chuckle. Golly, it's a bit uncomfortable to know that we can be whistled for like that. It's worse than what Father says about living at the mercy of the telephone.
But we want to be here, don't we? Said Lucy. If Aslan wants us.
Meanwhile, said the dwarf, what are we to do? I suppose I'd better get back to King Caspian and tell him no help has come.
No help, said Susan. But it has worked. And here we are.
Yes, to be sure, I see that, said the dwarf, whose pipe seemed to be blocked. At any rate, he made himself very busy cleaning it. But, well, I mean...
But don't you yet see who we are? Shouted Lucy. You are stupid.
I suppose you are the four children out of the old stories, said Trumpkin. Oh, I'm very glad to meet you, of course, and it's very interesting, no doubt, but... No offence.
And he hesitated again.
Do get on and say whatever you're going to say, said Edmund.
Well, then, no offence, said Trumpkin. But, as you know, the King and Truffle Hunter and Dr. Cornelius were expecting... Well, if you see what I mean, help. To put it another way, I think they'd been imagining you as great warriors. As it is, we're awfully fond of children and all that, but just at the moment, in the middle of a war... But I'm sure you understand.
You mean you think we're no good?
Said Edmund, getting red in the face.
Now, pray, don't be offended, interrupted the dwarf. I assure you, my dear little friends.
Little from you is really a bit too much, said Edmund, jumping up. I suppose you don't believe we won the Battle of Baruna? Well, you can say what you like about me, because I know...
There's no good losing our tempers, said Peter. Let's fit him out with fresh armour and fit ourselves out from the treasure chamber and have a talk after that.
I don't quite see the point, began Edmund,
but Lucy whispered in his ear.
Hadn't we better do what Peter says? He is the High King, you know, and I think he has an idea.
So Edmund agreed, and by the aid of his torch, they all, including Trumpkin, went down the steps again into the dark coldness and dusty splendour of the treasure house. The dwarf's eyes glistened as he saw the wealth that lay on the shelves, though he had to stand on tiptoe to do so, and he muttered to himself,
"It would never do to let Knickerbrick see this, never."
They found easily enough a mail shirt for him, a sword, a helmet, a shield, a bow and quiver full of arrows, all of dwarfish size. The helmet was of copper, set with rubies, and there was gold on the hilt of the sword. Trumpkin had never seen, much less carried, so much wealth in all his life. The children also put on mail shirts and helmets. A sword and shield were found for Edmund and a bow for Lucy. Peter and Susan were, of course, already carrying their gifts. As they came back up the stairway, jingling in their mail and already looking and feeling more like Narnians and less like schoolchildren, the two boys were behind, apparently making some plan. Lucy heard Edmund say,
"No, let me do it. It will be more of a sucks for him if I win, and less of a letdown for us all if I fail."
"All right, Ed," said Peter. When they came out into the daylight, Edmund turned to the dwarf very politely and said,
"I've got something to ask you. Kids like us don't often have the chance of meeting a great warrior like you. Would you have a little fencing match with me? It would be frightfully decent."
"But, lad," said Trumpkin, "these swords are sharp."
"I know," said Edmund, "but I'll never get anywhere near you, and you'll be quite clever enough to disarm me without doing me any damage."
"It's a dangerous game," said Trumpkin, "but since you make such a point of it, I'll try a pass or two."
Both swords were out in a moment, and the three others jumped off the dais and stood watching. It was well worth it. It was not like the silly fighting you see with broadswords on the stage.
It was not even like the rapier fighting, which you sometimes see rather better done. This was real broadsword fighting. The great thing is to slash at your enemy's legs and feet, because they are the part that have no armour. And when he slashes at yours, you jump with both feet off the ground so that his blow goes under them. This gave the dwarf an advantage because Edmund, being much taller, had to be always stooping. I don't think Edmund would have had a chance if he had fought Trumpkin 24 hours earlier. But the heir of Narnia had been working upon him ever since they arrived on the island, and all his old battles came back to him, and his arms and fingers remembered their old skill. He was King Edmund once more. Round and round the two combatants circled, stroke after stroke they gave, and Susan, who never could learn to like this sort of thing, shouted out, "Oh, do be careful!" And then, so quickly that no one, unless they knew, as Peter did, could quite see how it happened, Edmund flashed his sword round with a peculiar twist, the dwarf's sword flew out of his grip, and Trumpkin was wringing his empty hand as you do after a sting from a cricket bat. "Not hurt, I hope, my dear little friend," said Edmund, panting a little and returning his own sword to its sheath.
"I see the point," said Trumpkin dryly. "You know a trick I never learned."
"That's quite true," put in Peter. "The best swordsman in the world may be disarmed by a trick that's new to him. I think it's only fair to give Trumpkin a chance at something else. Will you have a shooting match with my sister? There are no tricks in archery, you know."
"Ah, you're jokers, you," said the dwarf. "I begin to see, as if I didn't know how she can shoot after what happened this morning. All the same, I'll have a try."
He spoke gruffly, but his eyes brightened, for he was a famous bowman among his own people. All five of them came out into the courtyard.
"What's to be the target?" asked Peter.
"I think that apple hanging over the wall on the branch there would do," said Susan.
"That'll do nicely, lass," said Trumpkin. "You mean the yellow one near the middle of the arch?"
"No, not that," said Susan. "The red one, up above, over the battlement."
The dwarf's face fell.
"Looks more like a cherry than an apple," he muttered, but he said nothing out loud.
They tossed up for the first shot, greatly to the interest of Trumpkin, who had never seen a coin tossed before, and Susan lost. They were to shoot from the top of the steps that led from the hall into the courtyard. Everyone could see from the way the dwarf took his position and handled his bow that he knew what he was about.
Twang went the string.
It was an excellent shot. The tiny apple shook as the arrow passed, and a leaf came fluttering down. Then Susan went to the top of the steps and strung her bow. She was not enjoying her match half so much as Edmund had enjoyed his, not because she had any doubt about hitting the apple, but because Susan was so tender-hearted that she almost hated to beat someone who had been beaten already. The dwarf watched her keenly as she drew the shaft to her ear. A moment later, with a little soft thump, which they could all hear in that quiet place, the apple fell to the grass with Susan's arrow in it.
"Oh, well done, Sue!" shouted the other children.
"It wasn't really any better than yours," said Susan to the dwarf. "I think there was a tiny breath of wind as you shot."
"No, there wasn't," said Trumpkin. "Don't tell me. I know when I am fairly beaten. I won't even say that the scar of my last wound catches me a bit when I get my arm well back."
"Oh, are you wounded?" asked Lucy. "Do let me look."
"It's not a sight for little girls," began Trumpkin, but then he suddenly checked himself. "There I go, talking like a fool again," he said. "I suppose you're as likely to be a great surgeon as your brother was to be a great swordsman, or your sister to be a great archer."
He sat down on the steps and took off his hauberk and slipped down his little shirt, showing an arm as hairy and muscular, in proportion, as a sailor's, though not much bigger than a child's. There was a clumsy bandage on the shoulder, which Lucy proceeded to unroll. Underneath, the cut looked very nasty, and there was a good deal of swelling.
"Oh, poor Trumpkin," said Lucy. "How horrid."
Then she carefully dripped onto it one single drop of the cordial from her flask.
"Hello, eh? What have you done?" said Trumpkin.
But however he turned his head and squinted and whisked his beard to and fro, he couldn't quite see his own shoulder. Then he felt it as well as he could, getting his arms and fingers into very difficult positions, as you do when you're trying to scratch a place that is just out of reach. Then he swung his arm and raised it and tried the muscles, and finally jumped to his feet, crying,
"Giants and junipers! It's cured! It's as good as new!"
After that he burst into a great laugh and said,
"Well, I've made as big a fool of myself as ever a dwarf did. No offence, I hope. My humble duty to your majesty's all, humble duty, and thanks for my life, my cure, my breakfast, and my lesson."
The children all said it was quite all right and not to mention it. "And now," said Peter, "if you've really decided to believe in us..."
"I have," said the dwarf.
"It's quite clear what we have to do. We must join King Caspian at once."
"The sooner the better," said Trumpkin. "My being such a fool has already wasted about an hour."
"It's about 2 days' journey the way you came," said Peter. "For us, I mean. We can't walk all day and night like you dwarfs." Then he turned to the others. "What Trumpkin calls Aslan's How is obviously the stone table itself. You remember it was about a half a day's march, or a little less, from there down to the fords of Baruna."
"Baruna's bridge, we call it," said Trumpkin.
"There was no bridge in our time," said Peter. "And then from Baruna down to here was another day and a bit. We used to get home about tea-time on the second day, going easily. Going hard, we could do the whole thing in a day and a half, perhaps."
"But remember, it's all woods now," said Trumpkin, "and there are enemies to dodge."
"Look here," said Edmund. "Need we go by the same way that our dear little friend came?"
"No more of that, your majesty, if you love me," said the dwarf.
"Very well," said Edmund. "May I say our DLF? "Oh, Edmund," said Susan, "don't keep on at him like that."
"That's all right, lass. I mean, your majesty," said Trumpkin with a chuckle. "A jibe won't raise a blister."
And after that they often called him the DLF, till they'd almost forgotten what it meant. "As I was saying," continued Edmund, "we needn't go that way. Why shouldn't we row a little south till we come to Glasswater Creek and row up it? That brings us up behind the hill of the stone table, and we'll be safe while we're at sea. If we start at once, we can be at the head of Glasswater before dark, get a few hours' sleep, and be with Caspian pretty early tomorrow."
"What a thing it is to know the coast," said Trumpkin. "None of us knows anything about Glasswater."
"What about food?" asked Susan.
"Oh, we'll have to do with apples," said Lucy. "Do let's get on. We've done nothing yet, and we've been here nearly 2 days."
"And anyway, no one's going to have my hat for a fish basket again," said Edmund. They used one of the raincoats as a kind of bag and put a good many apples in it. Then they all had a good long drink at the well, for they would meet no more fresh water till they landed at the head of the creek, and went down to the boat. The children were sorry to leave Caer Paravel, which, even in ruins, had begun to feel like home again.
"The DLF had better steer," said Peter, "and Ed and I will take an oar each. Half a moment, though. We'd better take off our mail. We're going to be pretty warm before we're done. The girls had better be in the bows and shout directions to the DLF, because he doesn't know the way. You'd better get us a fair way out to sea till we've passed the island."
And soon the green, wooded coast of the island was falling away behind them, and its little bays and headlands were beginning to look flatter, and the boat was rising and falling in the gentle swell. The sea began to grow bigger around them, and, in the distance, bluer, but close round the boat it was green and bubbly. Everything smelled salty, and there was no noise except the swishing of water, and the clip-clop of water against the sides, and the splash of the oars, and the jolting noise of the rowlocks. The sun grew hot. It was delightful for Lucy and Susan in the bows, bending over the edge and trying to get their hands in the sea, which they could never quite reach. The bottom, mostly pure, pale sand, but with occasional patches of purple seaweed, could be seen beneath them.
"It's like old times," said Lucy. "Do you remember our voyage to Terebinthia and Galma and Seven Isles and the Lone Islands?"
"Yes," said Susan, "and our great ship, the Splendour Hyaline, with the swan's head at her prow and the carved swan's wings coming back almost to her waist."
and the silken sails and the great stern lanterns, and the feasts on the poop, and the musicians. Do you remember when we had the musicians up in the rigging playing flutes so that it sounded like music out of the sky?
Presently, Susan took over Edmund's oar, and he came forward to join Lucy. They had passed the island now and stood closer into the shore, all wooded and deserted. They would have thought it very pretty if they had not remembered the time when it was open and breezy and full of merry friends.
"Phew! This is pretty gruelling work," said Peter.
"Can't I row for a bit?" said Lucy.
"The oars are too big for you," said Peter shortly, not because he was cross, but because he had no strength to spare for talking. Chapter 9. What Lucy Saw. Susan and the two boys were bitterly tired with rowing before they rounded the last headland and began the final pull up Glasswater itself, and Lucy's head ached from the long hours of sun and the glare on the water. Even Trumpkin longed for the voyage to be over. The seat on which he sat to steer had been made for men, not dwarfs, and his feet did not reach the floorboards, and everyone knows how uncomfortable that is, even for 10 minutes. And as they all grew more tired, their spirits fell. Up till now, the children had only been thinking of how to get to Caspian. Now they wondered what they would do when they found him, and how a handful of dwarfs and woodland creatures could defeat an army of grown-up humans. Twilight was coming on as they rowed slowly up the windings of Glasswater Creek, a twilight which deepened as the banks drew closer together, and the overhanging trees began almost to meet overhead. It was very quiet in here, as the sound of the sea died away behind them. They could even hear the trickle of the little streams that poured down from the forest into Glasswater. They went ashore at last, far too tired to attempt lighting a fire, and even a supper of apples, though most of them felt that they never wanted to see an apple again, seemed better than trying to catch or shoot anything. After a little silent munching, they all huddled down together in the moss and dead leaves between four large beech trees. Everyone except Lucy went to sleep at once. Lucy, being far less tired, found it hard to get comfortable. Also, she had forgotten till now that all dwarfs snore. She knew that one of the best ways of getting to sleep is to stop trying, so she opened her eyes. Through a gap in the bracken and branches, she could see a patch of water in the creek and the sky above it. Then, with a thrill of memory, she saw again, after all those years, the bright Narnian stars. She had once known them better than the stars of our own world, because as a queen in Narnia, she had gone to bed much later than as a child in England. And there they were. At least three of the summer constellations could be seen from where she lay, the ship, the hammer, and the leopard.
"Dear old leopard," she murmured happily to herself.
Instead of getting drowsier, she was getting more awake, with an odd, night-time, dreamish kind of wakefulness. The creek was growing brighter. She knew now that the moon was on it, though she couldn't see the moon, and now she began to feel that the whole forest was coming awake like herself. Hardly knowing why she did it, she got up quickly and walked a little distance away from their bivouac.
"This is lovely," said Lucy to herself.
It was cool and fresh. Delicious smells were floating everywhere. Somewhere close by, she heard the twitter of a nightingale beginning to sing, then stopping, then beginning again. It was a little lighter ahead. She went towards the light and came to a place where there were fewer trees and whole patches or pools of moonlight, but the moonlight and the shadows so mixed that you could hardly be sure where anything was or what it was. At the same moment, the nightingale, satisfied at last with his tuning up, burst into full song. Lucy's eyes began to grow accustomed to the light, and she saw the trees that were nearest her more distinctly. A great longing for the old days when the trees could talk in Narnia came over her. She knew exactly how each of these trees would talk, if only she could wake them, and what sort of human form it would put on. She looked at a silver birch. It would have a soft, showery voice and would look like a slender girl with hair blown all about her face and fond of dancing. She looked at the oak. He would be a wizened but hearty old man with a frizzled beard and warts on his face and hands and hair growing out of the warts. She looked at the beech under which she was standing. Ah, she would be the best of all. She would be a gracious goddess, smooth and stately, the lady of the wood.
"Oh, trees, trees, trees," said Lucy,
though she had not been intending to speak at all.
"Oh, trees, wake, wake, wake. Don't you remember it? Don't you remember me? Dryads and hamadryads, come out. Come to me."
Though there was not a breath of wind, they all stirred about her. The rustling noise of the leaves was almost like words. The nightingale stopped singing as if to listen to it. Lucy felt that at any moment she would begin to understand what the trees were trying to say. But the moment did not come. The rustling died away. The nightingale resumed its song. Even in the moonlight, the wood looked more ordinary again. Yet Lucy had the feeling, as you sometimes have when you are trying to remember a name or a date and almost get it, but it vanishes before you really do, that she had just missed something. As if she had spoken to the trees a split second too soon or a split second too late, or used all the right words except one, or put in one word that was just wrong. Quite suddenly she began to feel tired. She went back to the bivouac, snuggled down between Susan and Peter, and was asleep in a few minutes. It was a cold and cheerless waking for them all next morning, with a grey twilight in the wood, for the sun had not yet risen, and everything damp and dirty.
"Apples, hey-ho," said Trumpkin with a rueful grin. "I must say, you ancient kings and queens don't overfeed your courtiers."
They stood up and shook themselves and looked about. The trees were thick, and they could see no more than a few yards in any direction.
"I suppose your majesties know the way all right," said the dwarf.
"I don't," said Susan. "I've never seen these woods in my life before. In fact, I thought all along that we ought to have gone by the river."
"Then I think you might have said so at the time," answered Peter with pardonable sharpness.
"Oh, don't take any notice of her," said Edmund. "She always is a wet blanket. You've got that pocket compass of yours, Peter, haven't you? Well, then, we're as right as rain. We've only got to keep on going northwest, cross that little river, the what do you call it? The Rush."
"I know," said Peter. "The one that joins the big river at the fords of Baruna, or Baruna's Bridge, as the DLF calls it."
"That's right. Cross it and strike uphill, and we'll be at the Stone Table, Aslan's How, I mean, by 8 or 9 o'clock. I hope King Caspian will give us a good breakfast."
"I hope you're right," said Susan. "I can't remember all that at all."
"That's the worst of girls," said Edmund to Peter and the dwarf. "They never carry a map in their heads."
"That's because our heads have something inside them," said Lucy.
At first, things seemed to be going pretty well. They even thought they had struck an old path, but if you know anything about woods, you will know that one is always finding imaginary paths. They disappear after about 5 minutes, and then you think you have found another, and hope it is not another but more of the same one, and it also disappears. And after you have been well lured out of your right direction, you realise that none of them were paths at all. The boys and the dwarf, however, were used to woods and were not taken in for more than a few seconds. They had plodded on for about half an hour, three of them very stiff from yesterday's rowing, when Trumpkin suddenly whispered, "Stop!" They all stopped.
"There's something following us," he said in a low voice, "or rather, something keeping up with us. Over there, on the left."
They all stood still, listening and staring till their ears and eyes ached.
"You and I'd better each have an arrow on the string," said Susan to Trumpkin. The dwarf nodded, and when both bows were ready for action, the party went on again. They went a few dozen yards through fairly open woodland, keeping a sharp lookout. Then they came to a place where the undergrowth thickened, and they had to pass nearer to it. Just as they were passing the place, there came a sudden something that snarled and flashed, rising out from the breaking twigs like a thunderbolt. Lucy was knocked down and winded, hearing the twang of a bowstring as she fell. When she was able to take notice of things again, she saw a great, grim-looking grey bear lying dead with Trumpkin's arrow in its side. "The DLF beat you in that shooting match, Sue," said Peter with a slightly forced smile. Even he had been shaken by this adventure.
I left it too late," said Susan in an embarrassed voice. "I was so afraid it might be, you know, one of our kind of bears, a talking bear."
She hated killing things.
"That's the trouble of it," said Trumpkin, "when most of the beasts have gone enemy and gone dumb, but there are still some of the other kind left. You never know, and you daren't wait to see."
"Poor old Bruin," said Susan. "You don't think he was?"
"Naughty," said the dwarf. "I saw the face and I heard the snarl. He only wanted little girl for his breakfast. And talking of breakfast, I didn't want to discourage your majesties when you said you hoped King Caspian would give you a good one, but meat's precious scarce in camp. And there's good eating on a bear. It would be a shame to leave the carcass without taking a bit, and it won't delay us more than half an hour. I dare say you two youngsters, kings, I should say, know how to skin a bear."
"Let's go and sit down a fair way off," said Susan to Lucy. "I know what a horrid messy business that will be."
Lucy shuddered and nodded. When they had sat down, she said,
"Such a horrible idea has come into my head, Sue."
"What's that?"
"Wouldn't it be dreadful if some day in our own world, at home, men started going wild inside, like the animals here, and still looked like men so that you'd never know which were which?"
"We've got enough to bother about here and now in Narnia," said the practical Susan, "without imagining things like that." When they rejoined the boys and the dwarf, as much as they thought they could carry of the best meat had been cut off. Raw meat is not a nice thing to fill one's pockets with, but they folded it up in fresh leaves and made the best of it. They were all experienced enough to know that they would feel quite differently about these squashy and unpleasant parcels when they had walked long enough to be really hungry. On they trudged again, stopping to wash three pairs of hands that needed it in the first stream they passed, until the sun rose and the birds began to sing and more flies than they wanted were buzzing in the bracken. The stiffness from yesterday's rowing began to wear off. Everybody's spirits rose. The sun grew warmer, and they took their helmets off and carried them.
"I suppose we are going right," said Edmund about an hour later.
"I don't see how we can go wrong, as long as we don't bear too much to the left," said Peter. "If we bear too much to the right, the worst that can happen is wasting a little time by striking the great river too soon and not cutting off the corner."
And again they trudged on, with no sound except the thud of their feet and the jingle of their chain shirts.
"Where's this bally rush got to?" said Edmund a good deal later.
"I certainly thought we'd have struck it by now," said Peter. "But there's nothing to do but keep on."
They both knew that the dwarf was looking anxiously at them, but he said nothing. And still they trudged on, and their mail shirts began to feel very hot and heavy.
"What on earth?"
said Peter suddenly. They had come, without seeing it, almost to the edge of a small precipice, from which they looked down into a gorge with a river at the bottom. On the far side the cliffs rose much higher. None of the party except Edmund, and perhaps Trumpkin, was a rock climber.
"I'm sorry," said Peter. "It's my fault for coming this way. We're lost. I've never seen this place in my life before."
The dwarf gave a low whistle between his teeth.
"Oh, do let's go back and go the other way," said Susan. "I knew all along we'd get lost in these woods." "Susan," said Lucy reproachfully, "don't nag at Peter like that. It's so rotten, and he's doing all he can."
"And don't you snap at Sue like that either," said Edmund. "I think she's quite right. "Tubs and tortoise shells," exclaimed Trumpkin. "If we've got lost coming, what chance have we of finding our way back? And if we're to go back to the island and begin all over again, even supposing we could, we might as well give the whole thing up. Miraz will have finished with Caspian before we get there at that rate."
"You think we ought to go on?" said Lucy.
"I'm not sure the High King is lost," said Trumpkin. "What's to hinder this river being the Rush?"
"Because the Rush is not a gorge," said Peter, keeping his temper with some difficulty.
"Your Majesty says is," replied the dwarf, "but oughtn't you to say was? You knew this country hundreds, it may be a thousand years ago. Mayn't it have changed? A landslide might have pulled off half the side of that hill, leaving bare rock, and there are your precipices beyond the gorge. Then the Rush might go on deepening its course year after year till you get the little precipices this side. Or there might have been an earthquake or anything."
"I never thought of that," said Peter.
"And anyway," continued Trumpkin, "even if this is not the Rush, it's flowing roughly north, and so it must fall into the great river anyway. I think I passed something that might have been it on my way down. So, if we go downstream to our right, we'll hit the great river. Perhaps not so high as we'd hope, but at least we'll be no worse off than if you'd come my way."
"Trumpkin, you're a brick," said Peter. "Come on, then, down this side of the gorge."
"Look, look, look!" cried Lucy.
"Where? What?" said everyone.
"The lion," said Lucy. "Aslan himself. Didn't you see?"
Her face had changed completely, and her eyes shone.
"Do you really mean?" began Peter.
"Where did you think you saw him?"
asked Susan.
"Don't talk like a grown-up," said Lucy, stamping her foot. "I didn't think I saw him. I saw him."
"Where, Lou?" asked Peter.
"Right up there between those mountain ashes. No, this side of the gorge. And up, not down. Just the opposite of the way you want to go. And he wanted us to go where he was, up there."
"How do you know that was what he wanted?" asked Edmund.
I just know," said Lucy. "By his face."
The others all looked at each other in puzzled silence.
"Her Majesty may well have seen a lion," put in Trumpkin. "There are lions in these woods, I've been told. But it needn't have been a friendly and talking lion any more than the bear was a friendly and talking bear."
"Oh, don't be so stupid," said Lucy. "Do you think I don't know Aslan when I see him?"
"He'd be a pretty elderly lion by now," said Trumpkin, "if he's one you knew when you were here before. And if it could be the same one, what's to prevent him having gone wild and witless like so many others?"
Lucy turned crimson, and I think she would have flown at Trumpkin if Peter had not laid his hand on her arm.
"The DLF doesn't understand. How could he? You must just take it, Trumpkin, that we do really know about Aslan. A little bit about him, I mean. And you mustn't talk about him like that again. It isn't lucky for one thing, and it's all nonsense for another. The only question is whether Aslan was really there."
"But I know he was,"
said Lucy, her eyes filling with tears.
"Yes, Lou, but we don't, you see," said Peter. "There's nothing for it but a vote," said Edmund.
"All right," replied Peter. "You're the eldest, DLF. What do you vote for, up or down?"
"Down," said the dwarf. "I know nothing about Aslan, but I do know that if we turn left and follow the gorge up, it might lead us all day before we found a place where we could cross it, whereas if we turn right and go down, we're bound to reach the great river in about a couple of hours. If there are any real lions about, we want to go away from them, not towards them."
"What do you say, Susan?"
"Don't be angry, Lou," said Susan. "But I do think we should go down. I'm dead tired. Do let's get out of this wretched wood into the open as quick as we can, and none of us except you saw anything."
"Edmund," said Peter.
"Well, there's just this," said Edmund, speaking quickly and turning a little red. "When we first discovered Narnia, a year ago, or a thousand years ago, whichever it was Lucy who discovered it first, and none of us would believe her. I was the worst of the lot, I know. Yet she was right, after all. Wouldn't it be fair to believe her this time? I vote for going up."
"Oh, Ed,"
said Lucy, and seized his hand. "And now it's your turn, Peter," said Susan, "and I do hope—"
"Oh, shut up, and let a chap think," interrupted Peter. "I'd much rather not have to vote." "You're the High King," said Trumpkin sternly.
"Down," said Peter after a long pause.
"I know Lucy may be right after all, but I can't help it. We must do one or the other."
So they set off to their right along the edge downstream. And Lucy came last of the party, crying bitterly. Chapter 10. The Return of the Lion. To keep along the edge of the gorge was not so easy as it had looked. Before they had gone many yards, they were confronted with young fir woods growing on the very edge, and after they had tried to go through these, stooping and pushing for about 10 minutes, they realized that in there it would take them an hour to do half a mile. So they came back and out again and decided to go round the fir wood. This took them much farther to their right than they wanted to go, far out of sight of the cliffs and out of sound of the river, till they began to be afraid they had lost it altogether. Nobody knew the time, but it was getting to the hottest part of the day. When they were able at last to go back to the edge of the gorge, nearly a mile below the point from which they had started, they found the cliffs on their side of it a good deal lower and more broken. Soon they found a way down into the gorge and continued the journey at the river's edge. But first they had a rest and a long drink. No one was talking any more about breakfast or even dinner with Caspian. They may have been wise to stick to the rush instead of going along the top. It kept them sure of their direction, and ever since the fir wood they had all been afraid of being forced too far out of their course and losing themselves in the wood. It was an old and pathless forest, and you could not keep anything like a straight course in it. Patches of hopeless brambles, fallen trees, boggy places, and dense undergrowth would be always getting in your way. But the gorge of the rush was not at all a nice place for travelling either. I mean, it was not a nice place for people in a hurry. For an afternoon's ramble ending in a picnic tea, it would have been delightful. It had everything you could want on an occasion of that sort. Rumbling waterfalls, silver cascades, deep amber-coloured pools, mossy rocks, and deep moss on the banks in which you could sink over your ankles. Every kind of fern, jewel-like dragonflies, sometimes a hawk overhead. And once, Peter and Trumpkin both thought, an eagle. But, of course, what the children and the dwarf wanted to see as soon as possible was the great river below them, and Baruna, and the way to Aslan's How. As they went on, the rush began to fall more and more steeply. Their journey became more and more of a climb, and less of a walk. In places, even a dangerous climb, over slippery rock, with a nasty drop into dark chasms, and the river roaring angrily at the bottom. You may be sure they watched the cliffs on their left eagerly for any sign of a break or any place where they could climb them. But those cliffs remained cruel. It was maddening, because everyone knew that once they were out of the gorge on that side, they would have only a smooth slope and a fairly short walk to Caspian's headquarters. The boys and the dwarf were now in favour of lighting a fire and cooking their bear meat. Susan didn't want this. She only wanted, as she said, to get on and finish it and get out of these beastly woods. Lucy was far too tired and miserable to have any opinion about anything. But as there was no dry wood to be had, it mattered very little what anyone thought. The boys began to wonder if raw meat was really as nasty as they'd always been told. Trumpkin assured them it was. Of course, if the children had attempted a journey like this a few days ago in England, they would have been knocked up. I think I've explained before how Narnia was altering them. Even Lucy was, by now, so to speak, only one-third of a little girl going to boarding school for the first time, and two-thirds of Queen Lucy of Narnia.
"At last!" said Susan.
"Oh, hooray!" said Peter. The river gorge had just made a bend, and the whole view spread out beneath them.
they could see open country stretching before them to the horizon, and, between it and them, the broad silver ribbon of the great river. They could see the specially broad and shallow place, which had once been the fords of Baruna, but was now spanned by a long, many-arched bridge. There was a little town at the far end of it.
"By Jove!" said Edmund. "We fought the Battle of Baruna just where that town is!"
This cheered the boys more than anything. You can't help feeling stronger when you look at a place where you won a glorious victory, not to mention a kingdom, hundreds of years ago. Peter and Edmund were soon so busy talking about the battle that they forgot their sore feet and the heavy drag of their mail shirts on their shoulders. The dwarf was interested too. They were all getting on at a quicker pace now. The going became easier. Though there were still sheer cliffs on their left, the ground was becoming lower on their right. Soon it was no longer a gorge at all, only a valley. There were no more waterfalls, and presently they were in fairly thick woods again. Then, all at once, whiz, and a sound rather like the stroke of a woodpecker. The children were still wondering where, ages ago, they had heard a sound just like that, and why they disliked it so when Trumpkin shouted, "Down!" at the same moment forcing Lucy, who happened to be next to him, flat down into the bracken. Peter, who had been looking up to see if he could spot a squirrel, had seen what it was. A long, cruel arrow had sunk into a tree trunk just above his head. As he pulled Susan down and dropped himself, another came rasping over his shoulder and struck the ground at his side. "Quick, quick, get back, crawl," panted Trumpkin. They turned and wriggled along uphill, under the bracken, amid clouds of horribly buzzing flies. Arrows whizzed round them. One struck Susan's helmet with a sharp ping and glanced off. They crawled quicker. Sweat poured off them. Then they ran, stooping nearly double. The boys held their swords in their hands for fear they would trip them up. It was heartbreaking work, all uphill again, back over the ground they had already travelled. When they felt that they really couldn't run any more, even to save their lives, they all dropped down in the damp moss beside a waterfall and behind a big boulder, panting. They were surprised to see how high they had already got. They listened intently and heard no sound of pursuit.
"So that's all right," said Trumpkin, drawing a deep breath. "They're not searching the wood. Only sentries, I expect. But it means that Miraz has an outpost down there. Bottles and battledores, though. It was a near thing."
"I ought to have my head smacked for bringing us this way at all," said Peter.
"On the contrary, Your Majesty," said the dwarf. "For one thing, it wasn't you. It was your royal brother, King Edmund, who first suggested going by Glasswater."
"I'm afraid the DLF's right," said Edmund, who had quite honestly forgotten this ever since things began going wrong.
"And for another," continued Trumpkin, "if we'd gone my way, we'd have walked straight into that new outpost, most likely, or at least had just the same trouble avoiding it. I think this Glasswater route has turned out for the best."
"A blessing in disguise," said Susan.
"Some disguise," said Edmund.
"I suppose we'll have to go right up the gorge again now," said Lucy.
"Lou, you're a hero," said Peter. "That's the nearest you've got today to saying, 'I told you so.' Let's get on."
"And as soon as we're well up into the forest," said Trumpkin, "whatever anyone says, I'm going to light a fire and cook supper, but we must get well away from here."
There is no need to describe how they toiled back up the gorge. It was pretty hard work, but oddly enough, everyone felt more cheerful. They were getting their second wind, and the word supper had had a wonderful effect. They reached the fir wood, which had caused them so much trouble while it was still daylight, and bivouacked in a hollow just above it. It was tedious gathering the firewood, but it was grand when the fire blazed up, and they began producing the damp and sneery parcels of bear meat, which would have been so very unattractive to anyone who had spent the day indoors. The dwarf had splendid ideas about cookery. Each apple, they still had a few of these, was wrapped up in bear's meat, as if it was to be apple dumpling with meat instead of pastry, only much thicker, and spiked on a sharp stick and then roasted. And the juice of the apple worked all through the meat, like applesauce with roast pork. Bear that has lived too much on other animals is not very nice, but bear that has had plenty of honey and fruit is excellent. And this turned out to be that sort of bear. It was a truly glorious meal, and of course no washing up. Only lying back and watching the smoke from Trumpkin's pipe and stretching one's tired legs and chatting. Everyone felt quite hopeful now about finding King Caspian tomorrow and defeating Miraz in a few days. It may not have been sensible of them to feel like this, but they did. They dropped off to sleep one by one, but all pretty quickly. Lucy woke out of the deepest sleep you can imagine, with the feeling that the voice she liked best in the world had been calling her name. She thought at first it was her father's voice, but that did not seem quite right. Then she thought it was Peter's voice, but that did not seem to fit either. She did not want to get up, not because she was still tired. On the contrary, she was wonderfully rested, and all the aches had gone from her bones, but because she felt so extremely happy and comfortable. She was looking straight up at the Narnian moon, which is larger than ours, and at the starry sky, for the place where they had bivouacked was comparatively open. "Lucy!" came the call again, neither her father's voice nor Peter's. She sat up, trembling with excitement, but not with fear. The moon was so bright that the whole forest landscape around her was almost